Okay, so you should have your exams back. If you've looked at the handout sheet, you see that there's a couple of scores on your exam. So in kind of purple in a box, you should have a big number equals a number between 0 and 100 equals a letter grade. So the first number there is what your score should add up to. So if you added up all the points, which is always a good idea to check my addition, it should add up to that. And then what I do is I set the high score equal to 100. So if you take that score and divide it by 142, you should get the second number. And then that converts to a letter grade according to that sheet, and that's also there. If you look kind of in the bottom in ink, you should see HW equals some number divided by 255. So that's the total of homework quiz scores. So 255 was the highest that anyone had for a total homework quiz score. And your score is sitting on top of it. You can convert that to a percentage and see how you're doing in homework quiz stuff. Say again? Should be on the front page in ink. In terms of the home lab stuff, remember you're supposed to email me your stuff when you do it. So if I have an email from you for home lab 2, there should be a green dot on your name, so you can check to make sure that we're in communication about that. I'm a little bit less sure about the purple dots, which are the people who started home lab 1, because often their emails didn't specify home lab 1. They just said, you know, I showed you my lab today in class. So I usually go by the email. So check them out. See whether you have the appropriate purple dot if you've started home lab 1, green dot if you've started home lab 2. Questions? A little bit louder? Yeah, so Home Lab 2 is the one that you need to start first. That's where you're looking at the north.
And how, which color?
And Home Lab 1 is the moon one?
Yeah, but which color that was at?
That's purple. Oh, it's not. There's nothing there. It's on that sheet up there. No dots. The only dots are on that sheet up there. Other questions? Yeah, those are yours forever. And you definitely want to hang on to them because typically I make the final by taking your exams and putting them in a word processor and trying to delete questions. So your final will resemble your exams more than the online T1 exams were similar to yours, which I think you would agree. It's pretty close, right? It's definitely worthwhile looking at the old exams. I'm sure you all have questions about these exams. There's just as there was those screencasts with the answers to the old exams, so there are now at the website screencasts that have the answers to these exams. There's been kind of a computer glitch, so the audio is pretty bad on those, but it's quite, so I sound more like a robot than I hope I normally do, but I think you can hear all the words. So we start. Oh, darn it, I didn't pick those up from the secretaries. We start next week night labs. So the first night lab is, I think, Monday. And I have a pre-lab sheet for you to fill out, but I forgot to pick it up from the secretaries when I came up. So I'll do that sometimes towards the end of class. So you need to do that pre-lab before you show up in lab. Questions? And if you forget your dates, they're, of course, posted on that sheet there. Okay, so the last thing we talked about was basically Newton. And we've been working our way forward with explanations for why the stars seem to move the way they do in the sky. And there are lots of these people, like Copernicus and Tycho and Galileo, who were still accepting that explanations of the motion of the sky had to rely on circles. So the one guy who came closer to the truth was Kepler, but his rules are pretty weird, right? They have this aerial velocity and okay, ellipses as opposed to circles, I can live with that. we really like to have some explanation as to why Kepler's laws turn out to be the case. And Newton came up with these four universal laws of motion. So we throw out Aristotle's idea that the heavens are any different from the earth. These rules of motion should apply to any object, any place in the universe. And they seem like pretty simple rules. So the first rule is that if there is no force, then you're going to go forever in a straight line. So that's, I guess at first glance that maybe makes sense, but it certainly contradicts all your experience. Right? Your experience is if there's no force on an object, it may roll for a while, but it's going to stop eventually. And that's more in line with what Aristotle said. Aristotle said if you wanted to keep something moving at a constant speed forever, you had to push it. But Newton says not so, that if there is no force, it'll go forever on its own in a straight line just fine. So the first law covers an unusual case, no force is present. The second law covers the usual case where there are forces present. And of course, forces are then going to cause changes in velocity. And I didn't introduce it last time, but I introduced this Greek symbol delta, which usually indicates changes in things. So the change in velocity depends on the force that's applied divided by the mass and the time that you've applied that force. If you wait long enough, you can build up pretty big speeds. If you have a low mass, it's pretty easy to accelerate you. Big forces can give you big changes in velocity also. His third law is the one that is, in some sense, the most true. That is to say, Einstein made revisions to a lot of these forces over time. But everyone still believes Newton's third law, that if object A, in any possible way, any imaginable force, if we discover new forces, supposedly they have to act the same way. So if object A exerts a force on object B, then object B is going to exert an equal and opposite force on object A. So forces always add up to zero net-net. The horse pulls on the cart pulls back on the horse equally and oppositely. And finally, what usually doesn't get a number is Newton's law of gravity. So there are, we'll learn eventually, four fundamental forces, and gravity is one of them, and Newton was the first guy to write down the formula for that force. And of course, he's really the first guy who thought about gravity extending into the heavens. Right? That is the whole idea behind the apple and the moon story. So the same force that causes the apple to fall causes the moon to fall, that is to say, to go around in a circle. So how does going around in a circle work? So we have this, I hope, memorable picture from Newton's work that I think admirably explains how things work. So if you throw something harder and harder, it's going to go further and further. And if you throw it at just the right speed, the distance it falls every second is going to be made up for by the curvature of the Earth. And there's an additional property that we all know about by viewing astronauts, and that is to say they seem to be floating in their space shuttle. And that's really a fact that's due to Galileo. Things that are freely falling, things that have no force on them other than gravity, have exactly the same trajectory. So the pencil and the astronaut and the space shuttle itself all are moving exactly together, and so they just seem to float. Centripetal force. So you all learn this word centrifugal, which is the answer to no question in this class. Centripetal is a force that pushes something around in a circle. So if we have an object that's going in a circle, nothing is pushing it out. It takes something that's pushing it in. And it seems to contradict normal experience, right? When you go around a corner in your car, your books slide off the way the corner is going. So it sure seems like something is pushing you outside of the circle. But there is no such force that's doing the pushing. All that's happening is we have the tendency of things to go in a straight line. So unless something is pulling you around in a circle, you'll go in a straight line and you'll bump into the wall of your car eventually. So if we could turn off the gravitational force of the sun on the planets, they would start off going straight right out in whatever direction they happen to be going the instant the gravitational force was turned off. And we looked at the formula for centripetal force, which turns out to be your speed squared divided by the radius of the circle. And we did this kind of quick derivation for what that says. So if we have the centripetal acceleration, we have the force of gravity, we end up with the velocities getting smaller and smaller and smaller with larger radiuses. We know that the velocity is the distance you travel, which is the circumference of the circle, divided by the time it takes to go around, which is the period. And if we crank around on that for a while, we find out that the radius of your circle cubed is proportional to the period squared, which was Kepler's third law. Kepler didn't know why his law was the case, but Newton can now explain why exactly that's the result. And you might remember that when I flashed these transparencies before, this is the line you did for your homework, and I claimed if the sun were less massive, then the planets would follow this sort of curve. And I do that based on this law. So if the sun is less massive, there's less of a force that's pushing them towards the center, so they have to be going slower if they're at the same distance from the sun. If the Earth were more massive, if it's pulling them harder, then they need to be going faster because they're going to have a correspondingly larger acceleration. On the funny plot, so-called log-log plot, that those same results look, this what seemed to be a parallel line, what seemed to be a line, just gets moved up if the sun is less massive, and moved down if it's more massive. Okay, so in general, if we wanted to use Kepler's third law, we need to know the numerical value for g times the mass of the thing in the center, which for planets is, of course, the sun, divided by 2 pi squared. But there's one case that's particularly easy, one set of units that's particularly easy, and that's the units we use for the Earth, right? We say that the Earth goes around in 1 year, and we say that the distance that the Earth is from the sun is 1 astronomical unit. So if we put in ones for distance and ones for period, then it must be that in those special units, the value of this constant is just 1. And so if we wanted to know how long it takes to go around the sun, if you're twice as far as the Earth is, 2 AU, we can square the 2 and get 8, and then take the square root of 8 to get, I don't know, 2 point something, and that has to be the period. Vice versa, if we want to figure out what the mass of Pluto is, or excuse me, what the mass of Jupiter is, all we have to do is look at the moons of Jupiter, see how far they are away from Jupiter, see how long it takes them to go around. We know what Newton's gravitational constant is. You can look that up in books, so we can calculate the mass of Jupiter. So we can calculate the masses of things if we see them pushing something around, like a moon. But if we don't see them pushing around something, as was the case with Pluto when it was discovered, we don't really have any good way of finding out its mass. So that's how Pluto's mass was mismeasured. Well, misguessed is a better word. Originally, no moon that was then known, and so as a result, they didn't get the mass. Then they, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, the Naval Observatory saw the moon of Pluto, and then we knew what the mass of Pluto was. Questions? I want to come back to this idea of the square word, centrifugal, versus the proper word, centripetal, because it's so much a part of our vocabulary, and we need to, I think, kind of try and get it straight. So we've got kind of a setup here, which is sometimes done with motorcycles as opposed to balls, and if we let this ball go, it didn't quite complete the loop. But if we start it faster, it will complete the loop. And I think you'd all say that what's happening here is when you're going fast enough at the top, quote unquote, this swear word, centrifugal, is going to be pushing you against the top surface. So I don't like that. So what has to really be happening? Well, what's happening at the top, if you could imagine what would be the case if we didn't have this top surface, so the track ended here, the ball would naturally go above where the track was. So the track is actually needed here in order to be pushing the ball down, providing the centripetal force, the force towards the center of the circuit, that is pushing it around in a circle. Okay, it's maybe a harder way of thinking about it, that things want to go in a straight line, and if there isn't something pushing them that way, like your books that are sliding across your car, that there must be something that's doing the pushing, in that case, frictional force. So, I don't know, particularly after exams, people like demos that endanger the professor. So we've got a potential bath here. We'll see. I have gotten baths. Right, so you can keep the water in the bucket if you swing it at the right speed. Right, but it sure sounds like centrifugal force is the right answer to that. But it's really that if the rope wasn't there, the bucket would go above its current location, and the rope is pushing it down. So to take another sort of example, Superman, of course, who looks a lot like me, if you think about him flying around with this bucket, if he is accelerating fast enough, going in a straight line, he could keep the water in the bucket, right? The water would seem to be pushed to the bottom. And that's what's happening at the top of this arc. The bucket is actually pushing down in order to keep it going in that arc. We need a bigger centripetal force in order to cause that result. Okay? So there is no such thing as centrifugal force. It sure seems to be an easy explanation for things, but there is no such guy.
So is that basically just like a word people made up in like response to centrifugal force? Like if it doesn't actually exist, how did it
come into being? Well, if you think about it, there are lots of words for things that don't actually exist. Another example is rest. Right? There's no such thing as rest, according to Einstein. There's nothing that's any different whether you're in motion. So not uncommonly we come up with words that in fact don't exist because they seem to be nice explanations for things. And I guess I haven't actually looked up the history of that word, but I bet that it goes back to before Newton as an explanation for, you know, why the book slid that way when the cart went around in a corner. It sure seems like there is one. And it sure seems to be a natural explanation for lots of things. And if your three-year-old brother asks why the books slide, it's certainly a lot easier to say that it's centrifugal force. Okay. I feel the same way, incidentally, about the word inertia. Right? Why are you pushed back in your seat when you hit the accelerator? And I think what I was told as a kid, it's the inertia. But all that's really happening is that in order to accelerate you, there has to be a big force pushing on your back. And the springs in the back of that chair are what's pushing you forward. And the faster you're accelerating, the more those springs have to be compressed to supply that force. You're not actually being pushed down the road by the engine, you're being pushed down the road by the seat that you're sitting in. I don't see many people buying that one. It's true. So let's take a look at another kind of demonstration that deals with kind of this case about how things fall. So there's kind of an old story that if you shoot your gun horizontally and at the same second that you shoot, you drop a bullet, that both bullets, the fast moving one and the one you just dropped, hit the ground at the same time. Because what goes on vertically totally doesn't depend on how fast you're going horizontally. So both of these guys are going to fall at the same time. So there are disadvantages in literally doing that experiment, right? We need a very long room for the gun's bullet to hit the ground before it hits the wall. So we've got a wimpy gun, this little spring-loaded gun, and it's designed to do the dropping and the hitting at the same time. So some people can probably see that there's a peg that sits out on this side. and there's a ball with a hole in it that'll fit in the peg. And so when I release the gun, that peg is going to fall at the same instant that the pusher is going to push it. And if I have this thing set up right, you may notice I have wood down underneath it. That's so that you can hear the clunk. And if they hit the ground at the same time, there should be one clunk as opposed to clunk, clunk. One clunk. Okay, so what's going horizontally has no effect on what's happening vertically. So horizontally, this guy is going mostly at a constant velocity, but it's falling towards the earth at the same rate that a dropped ball would fall. So the only difference is that it's moving far enough sideways so that the earth has curved enough to make up for that fall. Okay, questions on any of that? Well, with that, I'd like to make kind of a change in emphasis. So Newton's explanations for things all really focused on change. And basically the idea was that by looking at small changes, you could add them up to get finite changes. And the complicated word for this is calculus. And Newton is the guy who invented the calculus in order to do these sorts of problems. And it's a great way to think about things, that forces cause changes, and if we add up those changes, we can get net results. But it turns out that there is a different way, maybe an easier way, of thinking about a lot of problems. And that is, instead of focusing on the things that change, focus on the things that stay constant. So this is exactly part of Newton's explanation for things. It's just that instead of focusing on the things that went constant, Newton focused on Newton focused on the forces that were causing changes. And it actually took a while for people to realize that inside of Newton's explanations for things, there were kind of subtle quantities which were in fact constant. So things that stay constant are called conserved quantities. And it's not that these things are conserved the way, you know, scarce animals are conserved, so we have hunting licenses. That is to say, conserved by fiat. These are things that are conserved by nature, kind of automatically, without anything going on. And the kind of the single most important conserved quantity we can think about is energy. So we can talk about the conservation of energy. Okay, so this isn't turning off the lights. This is the guarantee that the way nature works, energy, the same amount of energy is in the universe today as there was in the past. Energy can be transformed into various forms. But the sum is constant. So it's just another way of working problems, to focus on energy, which always has to remain constant, as opposed to, say, the position of particles, which are constantly changing. So what are some of these forms? Well, there are two broad categories. Well, maybe three broad categories. Well, I guess I'll go with two broad categories of forms. So the first one is the most obvious one. It's energy of motion. And you may have heard of this word kinetic, which indicates motion. So kinetic energy is energy of motion, and there's even a formula for it, which we're never going to use in class, but it gives you maybe a flavor of what kinetic energy is. It's 1/2 times the mass times the speed squared. So you can have lots of kinetic energy by going fast. You can have lots of kinetic energy by being a massive object that's moving at a moderate speed. So the other broad category, which is going to have lots of subcategories, is so-called potential energy. So potential energy is energy that exists as a result of the position. And typically the position vis-a-vis some sort of source of force. So if we think about something like a spring, if we stretch this spring, the spring is storing that energy. We had to do work in order to stretch it, and when we let the spring release, we can get that energy back. Probably a more standard source of potential energy is to think about objects that have been put up high. Right? Gravitational energy has been stored by putting this rock up high, and we can release that energy, convert it to another form, namely kinetic energy, by letting it fall. Okay, so energy is a result of special positions, and we've specified, for example, gravitational energy. And we get more energy if we're higher, if we have objects that are separated. We've got chemical energy. The energy that's stored in a battery because of the particular form of the chemicals that are in that battery. Got nuclear energy. So we can make a long list of various types of potential energy, energy that exists as a result of particular positions. Better put electrical up there to keep NSP happy. And I think one of the reasons that conservation laws took a while to figure out, right, like 150 years after Newton, is because if we just think about these quantities that I've mentioned, they don't stay constant. Right? So here this rock has lots of potential energy, and for a second it has a lot of kinetic energy, but look, it's down there at rest. So we seem to have lost energy. It went downhill and now it stopped. So what happened to all of that missing energy? Well, how did it, so in what form was it transferred to the floor? Well, certainly there was a big force. It pushed on the floor and the floor pushed on it. But forces aren't energy. We can have big forces without having big energies involved. Do the experiment again. You've never done this, I'm sure. So what happened to all of that energy? For a while it was converted into motion as the rock fell, but now the rock is stopped. It has zero kinetic energy, and it has less potential energy than it started with. The sums don't seem to add up. Did you see anything leaving when the rock hit the ground? Did you hear anything leaving when the rock left the ground?
No.
Yeah, so we had a certain amount of sound. And you know you have to plug in your stereo. Sound is energy. So some of the energy left in the form of sound, but actually probably not most of it. It may have sounded loud, but you can detect really small amounts of sound energy with your ears. So you might think about boxing, right? So if you box for a while, you may notice that the bag gets hot. Right? Or if you just rub your hands together for a while, your hands get hot. So thermal energy, heat. And that's probably where most of the rock's energy went to, is in heating itself just slightly from that fall. And you may have noticed I put thermal energy under energy of motion. So what is this thing really? What is it that makes something hot? Say again? How is it moving?
Molecules or particles.
Who told you about molecules? But I believe it. So I'm sure it seems a surprising result, but this floor is not solid, right? So it's made out of molecules that are held together by springs, and when you put something on this table, it deflects quite measurably just by something that weighs a kilogram. And usually these atoms are in constant random motion. Disorganized kinetic energy. On average, nothing's moving, because as much is moving that way as that way, but they're always in motion. So what thermal energy is it's the microscopic kinetic energy of lots of disorganized atoms. The hotter something is, the faster the atoms that make it up are moving. Now, this is a solid, so you can think about the atoms being held together by springs. The air in this room, the atoms aren't held together by springs. They're mostly just flying around freely. But they're moving really fast. They're moving typically supersonically. So every second you're being zipped by millions of individual atoms that are hitting you at the speed of a bullet and bouncing off. Lucky the bullets don't have much weight, or else they would be penetrating you all the time. But they're bouncing off, and the hotter the temperature, the faster they're going. So if we add energy to this room to make it hotter, all that's happening is the atoms are bouncing around in it at a greater speed. Okay, and what temperature is a measurement of, it's kind of a measurement of the energy per particle, kind of the average kinetic energy. Right, so Lake Superior holds a lot of energy even though it's cold, right? The energy, the thermal energy itself is an extensive quantity, temperature is a intrinsic quantity, an intensive quantity, that is the same even whether you have a drop of Lake Superior water or all of Lake Superior. So temperature is a measurement of kind of the average or the per atom kinetic energy of the things that are making up the material. Okay, so if we adopt this energy point of view, the reason this ball goes faster as it rolls is because it's converting gravitational potential energy into kinetic energy. And the reason it stops eventually is because it's converting kinetic energy into thermal energy. But at any instant, if we added up all of the energy, potential energy, kinetic energy, thermal energy, it should be exactly the same number as time goes on. So when I throw this piece of chalk up, it has lots of kinetic energy initially. It's converting that kinetic energy into gravitational potential energy as it goes higher and higher and higher. And when it's coming back down, it's doing the reverse. So what happens if you give it enough kinetic energy that it can totally escape the gravitational influence of the Earth? If you give it enough kinetic energy, there's only so much gravitational potential energy that's available, it'll go on forever. So if I throw this thing up hard enough, it won't come back down. It'll escape the influence of the Earth entirely. So we talked about that before. That's the escape velocity. So the escape velocity is having enough kinetic energy to escape the gravitational pull of the Earth. And it turns out that the formula for gravitational potential energy, and again, we're never going to use this stuff, it depends on the 1 over the distance that you are from the center of the Earth. And so if we equate the kinetic energy to the gravitational potential energy, so this is the mass of the Earth times the mass of the object divided by the distance we are from the center of the Earth, which is pretty much the radius of the Earth, we see that it is a velocity that matters because the mass cancels out, and the speed that's necessary to escape the Earth is just that. You might remember that the orbital speed is the same formula except without that 2 in there. So the escape speed from the planet is just the square root of 2 times the orbital speed. So historically, it may come to a surprise to realize that very soon, like 5 years after we sent the first rocket orbiting the Earth, we had rockets that were visiting other planets. Because you just had to go 40% faster to visit Mars than you had to do to orbit the Earth. Okay, so once you've achieved orbital velocity, you're more than half the way there. It's relatively easy to go the rest of the distance. Okay, so I can transfer energy, right? I ate my Wheaties this morning, so I have lots of... Oops, what happened to this? Did I burn out the light bulb? There we go. Right, so I'm converting the food energy into mechanical energy, and then eventually into electrical energy, and then into the light that's emitted from those guys. Right? Light is another form of energy, like sound. But the total amount of energy is kept constant in this process. It's a zero-sum game. So the main reason we're able to survive on Earth is, of course, is the sun is constantly pumping light energy to us that we can use for various purposes before it ends up as thermal energy and decays. So let's take another look at that process. Because if it is a zero-sum game, why is it hard to get energy, right? So Monticello is cranking out nuclear energy. Why don't we just gather it up and put it in again, right? Right? Go to the bathroom and have dinner. What's going on there? Well, so the second law of thermodynamics, well, of course, begs the question, what's the first law of thermodynamics? It's conservation of energy. That maybe begs the question of what's the zeroth law of thermodynamics. And there is a zeroth law, which isn't very complicated, but it's so uncomplicated that I'm not going to bother to explain it. So the second law of thermodynamics focuses on disorder. Putting Humpty Dumpty back together again. And we've got kind of a $10 word for disorder. We're going to call it entropy. And what the second law of thermodynamics says is, and so what happens for this process that I've described, right? I take organized motion and I convert it into light, which shines for a while and it heats up the walls of this room when it's absorbed, and we end up with disorganized energy. And what the second law of thermodynamics says is you have very limited ability to take disorganized energy and put it back into an organized structure. And so Lake Superior holds lots of heat that power plants have dumped their energy into Lake Superior, but you can't get it back out. The disorder always increases and it can't be reversed. Okay, so you can clean up your room, you can order a little bit of the universe, but overall, if you clean your room, if you order that piece of the universe, automatically you've dirtied up other parts of the universe, and the order has actually not been increased. There's always more disorder in the universe than there was yesterday, no matter what you do. And there's no way of putting this disorganized atomic energy that is now thermal energy back into the wires to be repumped to your house. Okay. Question?
So does it become a time when the disorder just becomes too much? And
yeah. Well, heat death. That sounds ominous, doesn't it? Yeah, so that's the idea that in the end all of the energy is going to end up as disorganized, you know, cold Lake Superior water, and we won't be able to do anything with that energy. Right? So right now we can survive because the sun is converting nuclear energy into energy that we can use. The sun's going to run out of nuclear energy, and its light is going to have shined out to the universe in disorganized fashion, and we're never going to get it back. So yeah, this is a viable concept, but it turns out we're going to die before this anyway. Yeah. Well before that. So aside from the occasional meteor hitting the planet, we're doomed by the sun getting a little bit too hot in about a billion years. So we won't live forever. More questions? Well, conservation of energy is in some sense the most important conservation law, but it's not really well suited to demonstration. Basically because so much of the energy gets used up, right? So the rock does come to rest, and I claim that it heats the rug a microscopic amount, but I can't really demonstrate that it did. Turns out it's really hard to measure the infinitesimal amounts of heat that correspond to quite noticeable amounts of macroscopic motion. So we'll leave that one up there. It's the single most important conservation law I can think of, but it doesn't lend itself well to tabletop demonstration. So the next great conservation law is conservation of momentum. And I guess if I say momentum, I need to define momentum. Momentum is something pretty simple. It's mass times velocity. And it sure seems like it's not conserved, right? If I drop this piece of chalk, it goes from zero velocity to a finite velocity in a relatively short period of time. I'm not going to try and catch that. Ooh, I did. But that's because we haven't looked at the whole system. So what happened when the chalk fell is there was an equal and opposite force on the Earth, so the Earth rose to meet the piece of chalk. Now there's a huge mass difference between those two, but the huge mass of the Earth going at some microscopic velocity actually has equal and opposite momentum to the falling piece of chalk. And in fact, the momentum started as zero, it ends as zero with the chalk and with the piece of chalk on the ground, and in the intermediate times it's also zero. Pretty impressive demonstration. I've made the Earth move twice now in this class. I don't know, so that's pretty unconvincing, I think. So let's take a look at another example, which again I can't demonstrate in class, but I think you can imagine that this is the case. So let's imagine shooting a gun on skates. And here I think you may be more, if you've ever shot a gun, you know how this works, right? The gun recoils, it kicks you back. So while the bullet is careening this way at Mach 2, you are going backwards at a much slower speed. But you weigh a whole lot more than the bullet. So the recoil from the gun is a result of conservation of momentum. And the ultimate source of conservation of momentum is Newton's third law, that if object A pushes on object B, there's going to be a reverse force. Well, in spite of making the Earth move, I don't think any of those demonstrations convinced you of much. So how about the next great conservation law? Conservation of angular momentum. Incidentally, so this is kind of a result of conservation of momentum for all of those collisions. But they seem to die out, of course, because we get disorganized motion there at the end in terms of the energy of the situation. Angular momentum. Well, I hope it's clear what's going to correspond to the speed of something. If something's moving in a circle, the thing that corresponds to that is the number of revolutions per minute. So the trickier question is what corresponds to mass? Because I can make this piece of chalk go many hundreds of revolutions per minute really easily. But I can't do that, with my baton skills. It's a lot harder to rotate this thing this way than it is to rotate it that way. It's hard both ways, I guess. There, it worked a little bit better. So the rotational ability of something depends not just on the mass, but on how that mass is distributed. So let's take a look at another example of that same sort of thing. So remember that Galileo says if you drop two objects, they're going to fall at exactly the same rate. So here I've got two objects that have the same mass, and you know that if I drop these guys, they're both going to accelerate at 9.8 meters per second until they hit the ground. How about if they race? Can I get over there faster than they can? I don't think so. We'll try a blocking action. Probably won't help either. You think that'll work?
No.
You're probably right. So who's going to win this race? Tie? Hoop? Solid disk? Who wins? No idea. Well, which one do you think is easier to turn? So, equally easy to turn? Do the twist? No. We'll see. I could get over there faster. You didn't think so. So who won? This guy won. So this guy is easier to twist than this guy. Same mass, same radius, but this guy has the mass all pushed out to as big a distance as possible, whereas this guy has the mass evenly distributed between the bottom and the top. Okay, so what counts for mass for rotating objects, and I'm not gonna, it has a name, moment of inertia. And I'm not gonna bother to give you anything like details, but it depends on the mass of the object and kind of where that mass is. If the mass is further out from the spin axis, it counts more than if the mass is on the spin axis. Right, so this guy here, same mass, of course, because it's the same object. The mass, if I spin it this way, is all concentrated close to the spin axis, whereas if I try and spin it this way, it's spread out from the spin axis. So it's harder to spin it this way than it is to spin it that way. Okay. So angular momentum is basically this moment of inertia, which is kind of the mr squared, times the number of RPMs that the thing is spinning. And what's nice about angular momentum, in addition to being important for this course, it's also pretty easy to demonstrate. So all I really need is to have something that is isolated from the rest of the universe, and we have what's called a spin table there, which you can see it's pretty low friction device. It'll spin more or less forever with one little push. So if the quantity mass times radius squared times RPMs is a constant, then if I change this number, of course I can't do much about this number, right? But if I change this number has to change. It would be neat to be able to do that with bullets, right? So you could, somehow or other, if you could reduce the mass of a bullet, if I could make this number small, this thing has to be a constant. If I could make this number small, I could go to arbitrarily large speeds, right? So you can imagine a spaceship which reduces its mass to a hundredth of what it was before, and it immediately goes 100 times faster than it was going. And when it reaches its destination, it just increases its mass back to its normal value. But, you know, dieting is not that easy. So, unable to change the mass of objects as far as we can figure out. But we can change the size of objects pretty easily. So, we need a body who is movable and who has a fairly strong stomach. Or not, depends on if you like excitement or not, particularly the people in the front row.
I've done this before, I know better.
So who doesn't know better? Okay, we got a volunteer. Well, that wasn't a volunteering, that was just a... Okay, good, step up here, step up to the plate. So let's talk about this process before we do it. So step up on the spin table. Nothing's gonna happen yet. So the plan is to have you, doing the twist here doesn't, do the twist for us.
I can't even play.
Yeah, you can, right? Okay, so if you start out with your mass far from your spin axis, then you're going to have a lot of I in relatively small RPMs. If you bring your mass back to the center of your body, you're going to have a small I now because you have a small radius, and you're going to have an increase in the number of RPMs. So first of all, you've all seen this, right? Ice skaters, right? Starting their spins with their arms out, spinning at a real high speed when they bring their arms into their body. Okay, so let's see if it works. Now we're going to exaggerate the effect by putting lots of mass out there. Oh, can you hold your, if you have your hand out, do you hit the wall? That's what I'm worried about. It's close. You didn't really want those fingers anyway, did you? Are they equally sized?
Yeah.
We hope so, huh? Yeah. Okay. So start out with them out far in a moderate spin. Now bring them into your body.
Okay.
You can put them back out if you want. You control the vertical and the horizontal. Bring them in again. Okay, good. Okay, we're done. At least for the time being. So, conservation of angular momentum, we reduce this, we have to increase that. So you remember Kepler's third law? Now, the analogy may not seem great because here we saw something that was rotating many times, and we're thinking about a planet here. We're thinking about things that have gone just about one rotation. But you might remember that they are going fast when their mass is close to the sun, and they're going slow when their mass is far from the sun. And it turns out exactly the reason for Kepler's second law is conservation of angular momentum. That's why it's working the way it is. Okay. So let's bring up another example of conservation of angular momentum. You remember long ago we talked about the precession of the Earth's spin axis. It's kind of disappeared recently. And we haven't talked about the why of it. What causes the Earth's spin axis to go in different directions? So, first of all, let's comment about why we should expect that it's not going to go in different directions. And the reason we should expect it not to change is that conservation of angular momentum. The Earth is a spinning object. If nothing is pushing on it, then it should point forever in the same direction, the way a gyroscope does. So you might know that gyroscopes consist of spinning discs, and the idea is that once you set them pointing, say, north, the airplane can fly any way it wants, and the gyroscope will continue to point north. Okay, so we supposedly can demonstrate this. Here's a little gyroscope. It's a balanced gyroscope now, and we've got the ability to spin it. Oh, I love it when things don't work. There we go. I wanted that too, but... So I can, if I can hold myself together, I can walk around this room and it still points the same way it was when it started. And so it doesn't matter how the base moves, the gyroscope continues to point in the same direction. And the Earth should work the same way, right? It's much more massive than this gyroscope. It should spin constantly in the same direction. But it doesn't. It is, over this very long periods of time, 20,000 years, it's going in a circle. Now it's pointing at Polaris. In the future, it'll point away from Polaris. And you remember there is that little circle on your SCO2, which showed its future and past locations. So what's going on there? Why the change? Well, it turns out that the Earth is like an unbalanced gyroscope, for reasons that we're going to be talking about. So if I unbalance this gyroscope, it wants to fall. So this is, I think, the craziest thing you're ever going to see. Obviously, it's unbalanced and it's going to fall. And it's hard to see why it should matter whether it's spinning or not, right? It should fall either way. And it doesn't do anything if it's not plugged in. But an unbalanced gyroscope, instead of falling, does something that's really strange. It's called precession, exactly the same word we use for the Earth. And if you notice carefully, it actually goes a little bit up and down-ish as it's circling. The Earth does that too. Okay, so for some reason, spinning objects don't fall. They go around. So maybe the first question to ask is, why is the Earth unbalanced? Why is it like an unbalanced gyroscope as opposed to a balanced gyroscope? You know, who is pushing on the Earth, right? Causing it to do this kind of funny motion. So we've seen that a gyroscope, if it's balanced, it points forever in the same direction. And this is a consequence of conservation of angular momentum. If we have something that's trying to twist the gyroscope, we have an external torque. We get a very odd response. So we saw that gravity is trying to twist this thing down, but the result was it went around. So the action, the cause and the results seem totally disconnected. So what is causing the twisting? What is playing the role of gravity to the Earth that is trying to twist it in some direction and do this dirty work? So it's a somewhat long story, but because the Earth is spinning, I hate to use this word centrifugal force, but it catches the feeling a lot faster than anything else. It's going to be fatter on its equator than it is at its poles. It's going to be elongated. Right? So if the Earth started out as a sphere and you spin it this way, great over exaggeration, it's going to end up with a bulkier equator. The polar radius is going to be smaller than the equatorial radius. So the Earth isn't exactly a sphere. About 0.5% bigger polar radius, bigger equatorial radius than polar radius. Okay, that doesn't matter. This thing was nothing like a sphere, right? So this thing applies to, this conservation of angular momentum applies to frisbees as much as anything else. So we need something that's pulling on it in order to cause this effect. And if we look around for something to be doing the pulling, the answer is the moon. Right, so you remember that the orbit of the moon is inclined to the celestial equator, which means that the moon is not going in an orbit like that, that leaves things nicely aligned. It's going to be above or below the celestial equator, so it might be here sometimes, it might be there sometimes. And the gravitational force on this bulge is going to try and twist the Earth so that the spin axis of the Earth corresponds to the plane axis of the moon's orbit. But oddly enough, that's not what happens. If you try and twist something this way, the result is that it moves in the perpendicular direction. And it never achieves its goal, right? So friction eventually makes this unbalanced gyroscope fall, but absent friction, and of course there's no friction for the Earth spinning in more or less in a vacuum, this precession is going to continue forever. Okay. Now, kind of no surprise, this is a pretty small effect. The Earth deviates from a sphere by only about 0.5%. The moon is pretty far away. And that's why this precession takes so long. The very gradual change in the direction of the Earth's spin axis. Absent the moon, the Earth would point in a fixed direction. But because of this effect, it's very gradually changing. Okay. And we'll come back to this next time because it's pretty weird and surprising, I think. But before we quit, let me mention one other important phenomena, and that's center of mass. So it's kind of no surprise that if you suspend this ball from an off-center point, and you wait long enough, it's going to come to rest with the center of the ball right below the suspension point. Right? And the same thing is true for unusually shaped objects, right? So this object, the center of this object, in some sense, the center of mass of this object must now be someplace directly below the support point. And if I change my support point, it must be directly below it again. So there's some point, you might call it the teeter-totter point, at which this thing would be exactly balanced. And that point is the center of mass. And it does work exactly like the teeter-totter sort of effect. Right? So if you have me on one side and, you know, my niece on the other side, I'm going to be a lot closer to the pivot point than she's going to be. So heavy masses are closer to the center of mass than other things are. So in the Earth-Moon system, we've got the bulky Earth and the relatively light Moon. There's going to be a teeter-totter point that's between those two points. And it turns out that the teeter-totter point for the Earth-Moon system is actually inside the sphere of the Earth, but it's not at the Earth. And if you think about it, that has to be the case because we've said that if the Earth pulls on the Moon is pulling on the Earth, and this pull is what's causing the orbit of the Moon, well, there has to be an orbit of the Earth, too. The Earth is orbiting around that center of mass point, which is more or less fixed. Okay, so the sun pulls on the Earth pulls on the sun, and the center of the sun is going around in a small circle because of the influence of the Earth. It's orbiting too, as it were. Well, we'll take a look at some online demos of the center of mass effect. Okay, so that's it. Well, let me remind you of kind of some things that are coming up. So I remind you about the lab, right? Lab start Monday. Ooh, I needed to get that pre-lab sheet, which I will do in my remaining 2 minutes. That's what I'll do with it.